Hello, and welcome to Ordinary Philosophy Podcast. Here, you can listen to interviews and audio renditions of pieces published at Ordinary Philosophy's website, dedicated to philosophy in the public square and the history of ideas that change the world. For more about Ordinary Philosophy, and to see the photographs and the sources and inspiration for each piece, please visit ordinaryphilosophy.com. I'm Amy Cools, creator and editor of Ordinary Philosophy. And before I dive into this next piece, I just want to apologize and acknowledge that it's been a very long time since I published a podcast. The reason being is I'm pursuing my master's degree at the University of Edinburgh, and I just found that the demands of writing my term papers and doing all that, as well as just trying to enjoy Scotland, immerse myself in Scotland, in the life here, meeting people, traveling, exploring, in all manner. I'm having the most marvelous adventure here. And it became a choice for me whether to continue with the podcast and writing for Ordinary Philosophy as constantly as I was doing, or enjoying Scotland, where I find myself. And I have chosen to spend much more of my time and energy, again, both in my studies here at the university, but also in just reveling in this place I find myself in. It's this most marvelous adventure. So now that my papers are in and marked, I am working on my dissertation, but still, it's more extended. I will try and write and podcast more often, but it will not likely be as often as it had been before. It'll be very spotty, very all over the place as the opportunities arise. I'll have more short pieces and check in and do all that. And then as I'm able and as the what I'm doing for my studies coming up, you know, especially for the PhD, as they more align with what I would do with Ordinary Philosophy and my schedule is more flexible, then I can start immersing myself more in it again. So anyway, that's just kind of to let you know why I've been neglecting Ordinary Philosophy for so long. So for all of you who have been waiting for the next podcast and the next blog post, I just want to say I really appreciate that. I thank you very much for being a regular listener and reader, and I will do my best to deliver as many good pieces as possible while still reveling in Scotland. So without further ado, let me introduce the next podcast episode. Oh, and real quick, this will be a multiple part series. So I will be returning to write the next piece that's going to come out very soon, and the podcast sooner than it had been before again, but I will be following up before long. So here we go with episode 114, The Bell Tower, Tower of London, Thomas More, Elizabeth I, and Other Histories, Part 1. Saturday, May 4th, 2018. I first visited the Tower of London in January of this year with my friend Stephen, a fellow student of history. I at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland, he at King's College, London. We had great fun, two history nerds running around London for a couple of days. While we were at the tower, I looked for the cell where Sir Thomas More was imprisoned for over a year before he was executed for treason on July 6, 1535. Like many brought up in Catholic families after the film was made, I grew up watching the adaptation of Robert Bolt's Man for All Seasons, starring Paul Scofield. Seeing it so many times, I believe I could have parroted the dialogue from entire scenes, from memory, with little effort. Going back and watching clips, I still remember just about everything that every character will say and do ahead of time. The tragic story of, and Scofield's compelling characterization of, the clever lawyer and saint captured my imagination. Since then, I've read more about him over the years and broadened my understanding of this man, who is much more complex than the stellar but somewhat two-dimensional martyr of integrity and righteousness portrayed in the film. Early on in our tower visit, I spotted a sign near the base of the bell tower, Just across and to the left is a place where visitors enter the tower, which identified the bell tower as More's place of imprisonment. Upon further inquiry, I discovered that it's not open to the public. It had been for a short while many years back, but wear and tear caused by visitors there and in other especially historically significant places within the tower caused them to be closed off again. The damage was minor, but happened more quickly than expected, even given the very large number of people that pass through every year, almost 3 million in 2017 alone. I persisted in my inquiries, as my historically nosy self is wont to do, and discovered that historians can and do seek and gain permission to visit. And so I did. So on the morning of May 4th, 2018, I arrive at the Tower of London's Raven Cages, this time with Lawrence as my companion. Unfortunately, Stephen had a prior engagement and couldn't make it. We're a little early for our assigned meeting time of 11 a.m. with a yeoman warder of the tower, one of the ceremonial guardians also commonly known as beefeaters. We're bleary-eyed since we had pulled an all-nighter. I was unable to get the night before off of work, so I went straight to the airport after my shift in the very wee hours of the morning. Lawrence very kindly met me there to keep me company. Fortunately, his sense of adventure is also strong and his knowledge of efficient travel to London excellent, so here we are, ahead of time. It's a very sunny day, almost hot, much different than my first visit to the tower, which had been, appropriately, moodily gray and drizzly. As we wait, we watch the ravens. It's long been a tradition to keep a certain number of these clever birds at the tower, where they're fed, groomed, and trained, their wings clipped just enough to keep them from going over the tower walls, but not enough to keep them from their perches. Some of them are roaming freely. Two of the ravens are nuzzling one another on a perch within one of the cages, one ducking regularly and enthusiastically to groom the other's neck feathers. Yeoman warder Simon Dodd arrives and greets us. He proves throughout our time together to be an extremely friendly, knowledgeable, witty, and all-around delightful man, and very generous with his time. I couldn't have asked for a better host or conversational partner. Lawrence is particularly interested and well-read in military history, and Simon has had a long and distinguished military career. So, we all have a lot to talk about. I only hope, as we tour and talk, that my sleep-deprived brain can form intelligent questions and process his answers. I take no chances with its ability to successfully retain information, so I take plentiful notes as we go. After introductions and a brief chat, we start right in on our tour. Before I get into the details of the day's explorations, let me offer a few more details about Thomas More, just in case this is your introduction to him, or just in case it's been a while since you read or heard anything about him and your memory is rusty on the subject. Born on February 6, 1478, he was a lawyer, scholar, writer, statesman, and Lord Chancellor of England from 1529 until he asked King Henry VIII to release him from the post in 1532, when More found himself no longer able to support the king in his power struggle with the Pope. Henry VIII's first wife, Catherine of Aragon, was the widow of his older brother prior to Henry's marriage to her. When the marriage failed to produce any living male heirs, Henry sought to have his marriage to Catherine annulled, freeing him to marry his paramour, Anne Boleyn. Trouble was, Henry had already sought and won a special dispensation to marry Catherine in the first place from the previous pope. The new pope was a virtual prisoner of the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, and Catherine was the emperor's aunt. So, as you can imagine, this whole annulment business was a sticky, tangled, religious, and political mess. Henry solved the problem in a typically aggressive and self-aggrandizing way. He tore the Church of England away from the Catholic Church and placed himself at the head of it, ruining careers, taking away titles, confiscating lands and property, and chopping off heads along the way. Moore and Henry went way back. Moore first met Henry when the latter was a young prince. In 1499, Moore's friend Erasmus brought him along to the palace where the royal family was staying. The bright, athletic, and precocious 8-year-old Henry was second in line to the throne behind his elder brother Arthur. Moore would become a huge influence on and trusted counselor of King Henry VIII until the king turned against him when Moore refused to formally acknowledge Henry as supreme head of the church in England. Erasmus was another central figure in Moore's life. He was 12 years older than Moore, yet the two became very intimate friends very quickly. Erasmus called Moore "Sweetest Thomas," and Moore called Erasmus "My Darling." These two humanist scholars bonded deeply over books and writing. Erasmus and Moore were inspirations for one another's most enduring works. Erasmus's In Praise of Folly. In fact, the book's original Latin title, Moriae Encomium, is a pun on Moore's name, and Moore's Utopia. When Moore decided to turn his energies to a life of public service instead of scholarship, Erasmus was disappointed, but they remained friends. Sadly, according to Moore's biographer John Guy, Erasmus effectively abandoned him in his troubles with the king. Yet Moore continued to write to him as a trusted friend up to the end of his life. The bonds of trust and friendship between Moore and Henry VIII only went so far, however, at least on Henry's part. From the beginning, Moore made it clear to Henry that his beliefs regarding the annulment and the nature and extent of papal authority did not accord with Henry's actions or with what was included in the final version of the Act of Succession. Henry promised to allow Moore the freedom to act in accordance with his conscience, but like so many of Henry's promises, this one turned out not to be worth much. Eventually, Henry, perhaps prodded by Anne Boleyn, demanded that Moore swear to the act. Moore found he could not, since the preamble of the act specified that the monarch was the supreme head of the church in England rather than the pope. As he told the king's ministers charged with administering the oath of supremacy to him, quote, "It were a very hard thing to compel me to say, either precisely with the act of supremacy, against my conscience to the loss of my soul, or precisely against it to the destruction of my body." So, to return to the story of the day. Simon leads us first to the place I first sought. The cell where Sir Thomas Moore was held. Well, maybe he was held here. There's plenty of dispute about this. There's no contemporary written record of where exactly Moore was held. Historians disagree, and their dispute continues in books, newspapers, and elsewhere. The Tower of London signage indicates that he was most likely kept in this Bell Tower cell. But Simon responds to my questions regarding this dispute that the chances may even be 50-50 that he was held here or in the Salt Tower, another very secure cell where politically dangerous but distinguished and influential people like Moore were held. He goes on to explain that the Southwest or Southeast Tower, the Bell Tower or Salt Tower respectively, were the only two likely candidates for Moore's cell. Outside of rooms in the central White Tower, which was not a place of imprisonment at the time, the Bell Tower cell is the most secure, with 11-foot-thick stone walls and 30-foot-deep stone foundations. The Salt Tower was also pretty secure, though not quite to this degree. Another Moore historian, Peter Ackroyd, believes Moore might have been held at least for a time in the Beauchamp Tower, where many other religious and political prisoners were held. But those cells were not so secure nor isolated as the Bell or Salt Tower cells. According to the notes for Ackroyd's biography, Sonia Johnson of the Tower of London describes Moore's cell as, quote, one of those apartments which were reserved for the more influential or privileged so-called guests of the lieutenant. His was a pentagonal stone chamber with a vaulted ceiling. It was some 19 feet in height, with a floor space of approximately 18 feet by 20 feet. The walls themselves were between 9 and 13 feet thick, the floor flagged through with rough and uneven stone, the windows merely arrow slits or loops, unquote. And it was cold. Cold enough that, Simon says, it was used as a larder for a time. In fact, the very cool temperature helped to preserve it, despite the damp. Johnson's description fits perfectly with this high-ceilinged, chilly stone room we're in. There are other reasons to think Moore may not have been held in this cell, at least not during the entire time of his imprisonment in the tower. Historical researcher Stephen Priestley told The Guardian's Maeve Kennedy that tower authorities tried to break up communication between Moore and fellow prisoner Bishop John Fisher, who is also opposed to the Act of Succession, much more openly so than Moore, and was also thrown into the tower for it. The cell above this one in the bell tower, which at the time could be reached by a narrow staircase from this one, was the one that held Fisher, or at least probably did. This leads Priestley to surmise that Fisher and Thomas would have been eventually placed where they could not communicate so easily with one another. I also consider the stories that Simon and others tell of Moore rapping on the ceiling to get Fisher's attention in the room above. But, as you can see yourself from the photos that accompany the written version of this piece in Ordinary Philosophy, and as Simon points out today, this hardly seems possible in the bell tower cell, no matter how hard you might pound on the ceiling, if you found a way to reach it at all. Perhaps then, Moore and Fisher were held, at least for a while, in neighboring cells where such communication was possible. Or, perhaps, the ceiling rapping stories are apocryphal and Moore and Fisher communicated only through smuggled notes and letters, as we know for certain they did. Overall, given what I've read and heard, I think, like Aykroyd does, that Moore's place of imprisonment changed at least once. In one of his letters written in 1534 from his prison cell to his eldest daughter and confidant Margaret Roper, who he called Meg, Moore reports that he was returning to, quote, close keeping and, quote, shut up again. Does this mean that he was imprisoned more securely, perhaps in a different room, or just not allowed to leave his cell? Aykroyd interprets Moore's comments to mean he was held in solitary confinement. But perhaps it could also refer to his being moved to a more isolated, stronger cell away from others where escape or rescue were far less likely. After spending some time looking closely at the bell tower cell, talking over its history, and discussing the likelihood and duration of Moore's imprisonment here, Simon, Lawrence, and I reemerge from the dim cell, blinking against the bright sun's light. Next, we make a short visit to the Queen's House. Simon tells us a bit about the history and historians of the Tower, and that there have been 160 constables of the Tower since 1066, the portraits of many of which are hanging here in the Queen's House wall. He tells us about the early to mid-19th century constable Duke Wellington, who worked to make the Tower function better, who made it look more like it did in the medieval era, increased its military management, and who was dismayed when tourism to the Tower drastically increased during his tenure there. Simon recommends us to read and watch David Starkey's, Lucy Worsley's, and Anna Key's books and audiovisual productions to learn more about Tudor history in general. In researching this piece, I recently read a Telegraph article about Starkey's sharp criticism of the BBC's historical miniseries Wolf Hall's negative portrayal of Thomas Moore. Simon also describes changing features of the tower over the centuries, with reference to a lovely old painting of the tower hanging on the wall, and indicates the route by which Moore would have been taken from the gate through which he entered the tower to his cell in the bell tower. We will see and talk about many, many more things during our day's tour of the tower, so I've decided to break up the story into multiple parts. Stay tuned for more about our tower adventure. And I'd like to end this episode with a special thanks to Lawrence Murphy, who did so much to fund and arrange and facilitate and make this trip much more enjoyable. So thank you, Lawrence. Ordinary Philosophy's website and podcast are independent and ad-free and depend on support from patrons and listeners like you. To find out more about how you can contribute to Ordinary Philosophy, please visit the subscribe, submit, and support page today. And if you enjoy what you read and hear at Ordinary Philosophy, please share with those you believe will enjoy it too, and take a moment to rate and review this podcast on iTunes. And thank you so much, as always, for listening.